You're listening to 99.1 WQRT LP Indianapolis, and this is Create Here. Produced by artists and curators from Big Car Collaborative, Create Here is your place to listen to conversations with people making intriguing, innovative, and impactful things happen on the cultural front in Indianapolis, Indiana, and beyond. Find out more and access additional episodes at WQRT.org.
This is Jim Walker, and you are tuned to Create Here on WQRT, and I am here with Sarah Green and John Green.
Welcome. Hello.
Hey there.
Well, thanks for being here. We had a great walk around on the campus here down in Garfield Park. It's been, you know, time is so weird now. It's been a while since we all talked, but I feel like because I've been able to keep up with what you're working on and both of these, I thought we just, you have a lot of things you're working on, and we should tell people what's coming up.
Sure.
But I thought since these two projects came out during the kind of time warp of COVID in 2020 with your book, and then John, your latest book came out in 21, and this is 22 now, if I'm correct, I thought that they're still new, right? Is that how you feel about them?
Pretty much.
Yes and no. I mean, I feel like... my book, You're an Artist, came out in April 2020, so it was real fresh, early pandemic. And I both think that it was like a great time for it to release, just because people were trapped at, or some people were trapped at home, those lucky enough to be able to be trapped at home were with needing things to do and needing ways to connect to other human beings, and art and art making can be a great part of that. But yeah, I mean, it does actually feel like a long time ago for me now.
Yeah, I mean, I think You Are an Artist, because it's so much about creating and how creating can be a pathway to community, which I know is something you think a lot about, Jim, and the relationship between making art and making community and making relationships. There's a reason that like all the same verbs are associated with that, I think. But because it came out right at the beginning of the pandemic, it was obviously like pretty rough time to try to publish a book. Right. Not a lot of people in bookstores. But also, I do think that it connects really, really deeply with people, maybe more deeply than it would have if we weren't going through a time when making feels so central to what makes life worth doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the thing about John's book, The Anthropocene Reviewed, coming out in 21, is that he was finishing writing it during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, I feel like my book was kind of like a manual for things to do during the pandemic, in a way. And John's book began to process it and integrate the before times and now.
And they're both, they are both really asking people to do something. So you don't give people assignments in your book, John, but you're asking people to be observant, thoughtful, and caring, and consider that climate change is important, and a lot of things that, and not just for a certain age of person or like a kind of person, it's stuff everybody could think about and, and process. And
yeah, I think for any book to work, to really do its best work in the world, it requires a generous reader who will bring their own experiences and their own feelings to the story. But with this in particular, because it's nonfiction, because it's about me, because it's about COVID, I was really trying to, as you said, like invite and encourage and call people to find ways to commingle their experiences with my own. And I very much felt like the book wasn't finished until that began to happen.
Yeah. I had such a neat experience with listening to your podcast that the book came from. I remember where I was, because, you know, everybody had to do something during COVID, and I walked a lot and just listened to things. And I didn't really before feel like I had time to listen to a lot of podcasts, but during I did. And so I remember, like, when I was looking back through them last night, I remember precisely where I heard the the one that it's not in there, the one about the bird.
Mm-hmm.
That one was not in there because it would be hard to translate to print, right?
It's actually in the audiobook, but it's not in the physical book because it's about this extinct bird species called the Kauai o'o, and it couldn't be... I felt like it couldn't be in the book and do its full work because you really need to hear the song of the Kauai o'o to understand what a loss the world experienced with that extinction.
Yeah, and I remember I was in the park, and I remember precisely where I was walking when I heard that, the sound of the bird and in the middle of the pandemic, that was really, you know, so I called Chate and I was like, you need to listen to this. This is such a sad but important story, you know. And I also felt like in both of the projects that you're doing and just in the way that you both approach things, there's something about mindfulness and kind of a, you know, you talk about it in the end of your book about being part of the earth and connect, but also just being part of the community of other people, which was so important during a time of isolation when people are pulling apart from each other.
I think I really enjoy I enjoy all of John's work. Yeah. I enjoy your fiction. But there was something really lovely to watch John in the process of developing the podcast, The Anthropocene Reviewed, and the book. It was almost like he was giving himself these mindfulness assignments.
Yeah.
To say like, okay, I'm going to review some aspect of the human-centered planet, and I'm going to try to pay attention to Diet Dr. Pepper. You know, like, I'm going to really try to do this, and not as like an expert who knows everything about it, but as a flawed human being with bias who's going to sort of like give my all to trying to assess this and acknowledge my point of view and just sort of like be there with whatever it is, whether it's a bird, an extinct bird song, or, you know, Kentucky bluegrass.
Right. Yeah. But it's interesting that y'all mentioned that because that's very much something that I learned from Sarah and from Sarah's work. Like, it was through doing art assignments, both in the original PBS series that Sarah had doing encouraging people to do art assignments, and through the book, that I started to experience how when you pay a certain kind of attention, everything becomes interesting. Everything mm-hmm. can be important. It's really the quality of the attention, the carefulness of it that matters more than what you're paying attention to. And I learned that through doing... several times when I was working on the book, I would go back to You Are an Artist, and I would look for assignments that could, like, help me find a way to an idea.
Yeah.
Like, there's an essay that didn't end up in the book, but that I really enjoyed writing and learning about, that's about the first spacewalk, the first time this guy, Alexei Leonov, put on a spacesuit and went out into the vacuum of space connected to the Soyuz mm-hmm. space capsule only by a tether.
And he was an artist.
The astronaut. Yeah. And so he made the first artwork from space. He got back into...
The first Earthrise drawing.
Yeah. He got back into the capsule after almost dying because they had miscalculated a bunch of things. And he gets back in. And he's terrified and he's overwhelmed and he doesn't know what to do. And his friend is trying to calm him down and says, like, we should make some reports about the mission. And he's like, I think I'm going to make a drawing. And it's just so that to me is so beautiful. And the story of Alexei Leonov, as it's usually told, is all about the spacewalk and all the challenges that they had and all the ways that they almost died. But like, to me, the overwhelmingly most interesting part is that he drew... He drew the sun rising behind the earth because it was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the first person to see that, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was the first person, and to try to understand. even how do I capture this with colored pencils in a weightless environment when I'm really stressed out and I have like 6 minutes.
Right.
Well, and
it's the ultimate constraint. Like, artists need constraints. Alexei Leonov had the best
had
set of
many constraints and like a tiny little colored pencil set.
Yeah.
Right. But I remember when I first read about it, I was making a video for the art assignment about art in space.
Yeah.
And I was reading the story about Alexei Leonov, and I was like, John is going to really dig this.
Yeah. I mean, that gets at something that I think is so fortunate and important about having creative people in your life who you work with and can bounce ideas off of. Like, obviously, we're extremely lucky that this happened to us in a marital partnership, but I think other people have it in other relationships. But having that person who comes across a story and knows it's for you,
right,
is just so valuable and so lovely. And it's such an act of love. Every time Sarah says to me, like, hey, I think that you might be interested in the history of Piggly Wiggly because it seems like it's up your alley and I just learned about it.
Yeah.
Like, that's such an act of love. And then if I can do that for Sarah by like pointing her to art history TikToks or whatever, I always feel really lucky.
Well, but that's really what you're doing here. You know, what you're doing with Tube Factory and the Big Car Space and all of this amazing development over here is you're bringing people into community with each other and allowing those overlaps to happen.
Well, and that's what I was thinking about this last night when I was looking at both your books, the history pieces that you put in here, and you both have done other online shows that were about history, about knowing stuff. And, you know, because the art assignment went down a path with some history ones about surrealism, which I have showed my art classes. But you guys are kind of like doing what you were just talking about, but for everyone who pays attention to what you're sharing. Mm-hmm. Like, you should really know about, you should know about, like, you go through the list, you should know about Yoko Ono, John Cage. Mm-hmm. All the poetry that's in here is great, too. Like, that's all stuff that people are gonna, you know, who's John Ashbery? Oh, yeah. Now you got, you know, Mary Oliver. Like, they're in, and E.E. Cummings, like, that's probably the first time so many people have heard about those poets, just like many of the artists in history or contemporary artists. So it's basically like everybody has a friend who's like, have you ever heard of William Burroughs? Have you ever heard of John Cage? Have you ever heard of Yoko Ono? And so many people are like, no.
Right.
Those people mean so much to us.
But I think that's the best way to learn about historical occurrences, people, artwork, is to have it be directly connected to something in your current life.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this reminds me of Yoko Ono, you know, this from now reminds me of Yoko Ono, and it's still relevant,
right?
You know, and it's not like you're sitting through a chronological history course something, but it's like, hey, this is not dead. This is still, this relates to your life now.
It's all context.
Yeah. And knowing that art is not a cold, dead thing, but something that is informing our now is really, I think it really changes people's relationship with art. The same is true for history. When you're taught that history is a series of dates that led to the emergence of the best possible order of communities, which is called American democracy, like, and it's
right,
and it feels, you know, and it feels like it's this very simple, straightforward narrative. It's also feels really disconnected from the reality that students are living in, because that narrative does not, in a lot of cases, speak to their experience.
Right.
But if you have more expansive and more nuanced narratives of history, people connect to it very deeply. And I remember being in high school and being like, this history stuff, it is utterly irrelevant.
Right.
Like, we've fixed all these people's problems, so why do I have to learn about their problems? And it wasn't until I got to college and I started studying different kinds of history that I could start to think like, well, actually, you know, the French Revolution has a lot to teach us about both the excitement and the dangers of, you know,
violent revolution.
Yeah. And those are relevant lessons for today, but it's also a window into understanding how people lived for almost the whole time that we've been here.
Right.
And that gives us a sense of like the ways in which things are actually different and which of those things do we want to grasp and which of those do we not want to. And I think this is true for art as well. A lot of times the way that it's taught, it all feels inevitable. Mm-hmm. It feels like the Renaissance inevitably led to this.
This begat.
Yes,
right.
The begats.
Yeah.
This impressionism begat, right. Abstraction begat, whatever.
Right. When all the while there was fascinating, better things happening in other parts of the
right.
world.
Right. Yeah. But that way of listing things as begats makes it all feel inevitable and it makes it feel like whatever is happening now is also inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great Philip Roth line, or it's actually a great Kurt Vonnegut line, history is merely a list of surprises. It can only prepare us to be surprised again.
Yeah.
And thinking about history or art history that way, mm-hmm. not as an inevitability of mm-hmm. begats, but instead as anything could happen.
Right.
Nothing is inevitable.
Right.
Is much more exciting.
Well, and also that history is heavily informed by those who write it.
Right.
So,
yes,
that's what I mean, I went to school to learn about art and art history. And if you study any subject, you learn a certain narrative. And then I feel the more you get along the way in your study, you sort of have to unlearn it.
Sure.
And break it apart, right? And part of my work has been trying to come up with a way to learn about things in history without having to learn the narrative first,
right.
which I still don't know if that's possible, really.
Yeah.
Maybe you need to understand it one way in order to complicate it. But I think, Anthropocene Review does that too. It's not like you read this and you're going to become a master in all of these subjects,
right.
or you're going to know A, B, and C. It's sort of like a grab bag of history and ideas.
With both of these projects and all of your work individually, there's always this stuff about science and chaos, and you know that gets in there, mm-hmm. In artists' work, like with Surrealists and Fluxus and everybody, there's all this out of your control. And I always feel like when you're bringing in science and the stars and everything into the mix, that is to kind of keep reminding us of that. But I feel like that's in both of these projects, where mm-hmm. it's just like, hey, these are all things, tangible, real-life things, but there's all this stuff that's way beyond your...
Yeah. Well, you have to be. I'm interested in how we contextualize ourselves in different moments and at different scales. You zoom all the way in, and like my life is extremely important to me,
mm-hmm.
and my relationships are the most important thing in the universe because they are to me.
Right.
But you zoom out a little further, and you're looking at Indianapolis, and you're thinking, well, I'm a part of this community, and how am I participating in that community? Or I'm a part of, you know, these online communities, and what does it mean to be in these virtual spaces? Does that impoverish the real life spaces that I'm living in, or does it, or can I use it somehow to enrich them? And then you zoom out further, and you're like, oh, I'm on a rock.
Well, what is the essay right before the start of the pandemic? John had an in-person event up in Carmel.
Yeah.
And I had our kids there, and you read an early version of one of the essays in the book.
It's about our humanity's temporal range. So species has an amount of time that they live. That's part of being a species. And that's called your temporal range.
Right.
And John was reading this essay. And I looked down at our daughter, who was like 6 at the time. And she was like looking at me. And I was like, and afterwards, she was like, is all that true?
I think it was the first time that Alice found out that the sun is going to eat the earth.
Right.
But I was like, but not for a long time.
Yeah. Well, the point I was trying to make is that the sun is going to eat the earth, and boy, will we be lucky if that's ever an issue for us.
Right.
But that's not
for
when you're
us
6.
Humans, not us personally.
Oh, no. Right. Yeah. I'm not concerned about us. Yeah.
Which is important to establish to a 6-year-old. But
there's still time. Yeah.
Yeah. Plenty of time. Plenty of time, Alice.
But I always enjoy the way that John sort of does like a hairpin turn where we're like looking at a granular, finite, tangible idea. And then he's like, oh, but we're on a rock.
Right.
Yeah.
And then linking it back, I mean, fortunately for everybody who reads what you to do or watches it, you're interesting people because you're sharing about your life. And I feel that it adds, sometimes when people write about a subject and then they insert themselves in there, not interesting, it takes away from it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's part of the path of meandering through this work, including your introduction about Lonnie Holly. And, you know, we're probably one of the only radio stations that we play Lonnie Holly's music. And
it's amazing.
I love it.
Is it great?
It's awesome. So good.
Yeah.
But that personal aspect is in maybe even more than ever for you. It's more vulnerability than and because you were saying it's not in code. It's talking directly about truths in your life.
Yeah. When I'm writing fiction, I never feel like I'm writing about myself. Right. The whole point is to try to not be myself for a while. And so I have a distance between my fiction and myself. Sometimes readers don't, you know, because they may know me as a YouTuber or whatever, and they may try to read my biography into the novel, but I don't feel that way when I'm writing. I feel like finally I'm not stuck inside of this skin-encased bacterial colony.
Right.
But when I'm writing nonfiction, I am, you know, with this book, it really was the first time I was trying to write about myself and my own way of looking at the world. And I knew that was going to demand a certain amount of vulnerability. But I'd also seen some of the ways that Sarah handled that in You Are an Artist, how she was able to write about herself while still protecting, like the essential privacy of our marriage and the essential privacy of our family. And so I wanted to try to find a way to do that in a way that was analogous to the way that she did it, even though I knew I was going to have to be writing more about myself.
Yeah. Well, the introduction to You Are an Artist was a real stretch for me, actually.
Yeah, it was hard.
I come from art museums where, like, the whole point is to have, like, this institutional voice where, like, I am not a curator writing to you as Sarah Green from my office with my set of experiences, but I'm telling you as the voice of the museum what this work is and what it means and what you should think about it, too. Right. And so and part of doing curatorial work is that I love hearing from artists, and I love, like, making a platform for artists and seeing what they think about things.
Sure.
Like, I know what I think.
Right.
That's not interesting. But working on the introduction, my editor and John, like, really pushed me, like, why did you write this? Why are you doing this? And I think it was a good exercise for me to, like, try to find that balance. I think everybody tries to now, existing on the social internet, you know, to what extent do you share yourself? To what extent is it, like, productive vulnerability? And to what extent are you performing a self that is not real?
Right.
So I think that's something that we're both always trying to grapple with.
Well, and they were so important with both of these books because people like me and so many other people were familiar with all the many of the assignments because they've been watching them and then had heard. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't know what percentage of people probably already heard it before, but it's probably a pretty high percentage had experienced some piece of these two books already in one way or the other. But then when you come into it, there's these new pieces that are in both cases super important and powerful. I feel like they add so much that it creates a whole level of experience that that adds to what you might have already had.
That's great to hear. Well, and I think I want to hear what you have to say too, John, but, like, this is also an outgrowth of, like, working on the internet. Like, you make videos, you make podcasts, and they go out into the ether, and they're not there. You know, they're not a cohesive collection. So definitely for You Are an Artist, and I think also for the Anthropocene Review, like, it's making something physical and tangible out of this digital universe.
Yeah.
And so, like, it was a good opportunity for us to, like, think about what all this diverse production media felt or is when you, like, gather it together.
And how do you find ways to make something that is truly cohesive so that even though, you know, no book of essays or few books of essays have a narrative in the traditional sense,
right.
like they have to, you know, be able to live distinctly on their own, but I did want them to have an overall narrative, like an overall series of arguments about the relationship between despair and hope and about the relationship between humans and non-human life on the planet. Mm-hmm. And so, like, trying to draw those two arcs, this personal one of my journey away from despair and beginning to see despair as cheap and kind of an easy way out from the size of the problems we face, and then this sort of journey that we're on as a species toward being so overwhelmingly powerful that we sometimes or often don't even understand the consequences of that power.
Right.
So it was about trying to form that cohesive whole for me, and that was a really fulfilling experience. But it gets back to something that Sarah was saying earlier, which is that especially when you're writing anything remotely personal, but I think to some extent, even when you're not, you are trying to find your voice, and you're trying to find, like, what does my voice sound like if it isn't the institutional voice of the museum? Like, right. what does my voice sound like as me? And that is that's a lifelong process. Like, that's one of the things I find most interesting about writing, because what my, like, finding my voice wasn't an event.
Right.
It's not like I found my voice in 2003 and wrote my first novel and it came out and that was my voice. That was my voice then.
Right.
But I want to keep trying to find...
It's always changing.
It's always changing. And I want to keep, I want to keep trying to find
what's my voice in 2022?
Yeah, different. Yeah, my set of concerns is different. But also the way that I choose to write about them is different.
And I think what's really unique in the way you do production, your actual physical voice is a part of this.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I've ever experienced a book first by listening to it.
Yeah.
Which I did with this one.
Right.
And very much all a lot of these, I heard you narrating the things that were in the, because when you structure your book, Sarah, it's the meat of it is more in the setup. And a lot of times the artist had just the shortest little instruction. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like this little thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then you set that all up and give context and history, and there's two pages of that, and then the instructions are pretty brief, but mm-hmm. we know the artist and what they're all about. And that's what we would hear you tell us,
right.
typically, and then the artist would talk a little bit, or more sometimes, but there was always that context that we could hear through your voice.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
you're real people
right.
to yeah. a lot of the first experience that people have with these.
Right. And I think, you know, having done the Art Assignment video series, like over 6.5 years was gradually understanding that my voice was part of it.
Yeah.
That it was something, you know, our first assignment we filmed with you.
Right.
And... you know, I was really uncomfortable, like, yeah. putting myself forward. Mm-hmm. And it really took a long time. And I never, like, fully, about the voice thing, like, I never, like, fully arrived.
Right.
I'm like, I've done it.
Yeah.
I've hit my stride. It's just, like, all of a sudden I was kind of like, okay, it's a little less uncomfortable.
You did. I have to disagree. I think that you found a really effective way of using your voice to talk about art. And I think that... I think that part of the reason why your voice was so helpful, and even in the writing of the book, like, we talk a lot about the benefits of reading something out loud when
yeah.
you're writing,
mm-hmm.
so that you can you can hear out loud the rhythm and the structures of each sentence,
mm-hmm.
and see where they don't work, because where they don't work out loud, they will ultimately, like, won't right. work in an iRead. And I actually think it changed your writing
mm-hmm.
to do so much reading aloud and to write
oh, for
so
sure.
much for your voice, like, had this weird virtuous cycle effect where as you wrote for your voice, you got better at speaking.
Oh, yeah. But, like, I don't think I could go back and write a museum essay again. Like, I just don't think. I mean, I could. It would be a different beast.
Yeah, it would be better, probably.
it might be.
Even museum yeah. people, or, like, when I write grants, which I have to do a lot of, people like to read things that that they can enjoy reading
right.
a little more. Yeah. And so the structures that we were used to with writing for academic reasons or for museums or for grants, that's just really not very empathetic to whoever has to read it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, so we do that too. We read, when we're writing a grant, we'll read it out loud to Chate, and I'll sit across the kitchen table and read it out loud to each other. And, you know, and that's gotta help.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
For sure.
Your new things you're doing. So we've talked about what you've been working on or what you did in the past. And are you continuing with both of these projects in a way, maybe? I don't know if you're picking yours back up, John.
I mean, to some, I think we are in a time of not knowing what we're going to do next, which is...
Which also coincides with doing a lot of other things. Like I'm not actively producing new art assignment videos, but I'm producing a series called Ours Poetica, O-U-R-S Poetica. It's a poetry series made in collaboration with the Poetry Foundation that's on YouTube.
Yeah. Oh, great.
So that's going well and going strong, and it's great. And then, you know, I'm like taking pottery classes. Nice.
Yeah, Sarah's doing a lot of art making.
And making more art.
Great, great.
Which is awesome. Yeah. And I've been, I mean, the biggest part of my professional life is still working on our educational video projects with my brother and supporting him. And the team of people who work on that as best I can. And then there's also, for the last several years, we've been leading a capital campaign to support a maternal hospital in the Kono district in Sierra Leone.
Yeah.
And so that's a big, big part of my professional life as well. And then in terms of writing, Sarah and I have always collaborated, and we've never really acknowledged the extent of the collaboration, how like complete, to me anyway, how complete it is, how much like all of our...
Well, and Jim understands
you
as well.
Right. Because
you like, and Chate.
Yeah. All of our work is so wrapped up in each other that it's almost inseparable to me. Like, I don't really think of, any of that stuff separate from our partnership together.
Right.
And so I would like to find ways to collaborate more, even more like more openly,
I guess. We've been doing some sort of writing experiments where we're working on something together.
Experiments.
Which like we don't have a plan for, but it's just kind of.
Yeah, we may do that. I'm preparing a pitch right now, Jim, actually, for a different kind of collaboration with Sarah where she...
Do I know about this?
No.
Here we go.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. I'm going to pitch it to you right now.
Okay.
It's a different kind of... And this is for nobody, probably.
Okay.
It's tiny audience, if any
That's
audience.
That's what we always say when we start a project.
It's like a zine.
I'm going to write this anonymously.
Yeah, no. But the idea is that you... we respond to each other visually and textually and visually and textually.
Mm. Nice.
We have a conversation.
I like it.
Yeah, like, because before Sarah and I started dating, we exchanged emails for a year.
Yeah.
And I think about this period all the time that, like, I was writing Looking for Alaska, my first novel, but really what I was writing was love letters to Sarah because I spent way more time writing those emails than I did writing novels. I'm a little...
And they were, just to clarify, they weren't like outward love letters.
No,
like about other things.
Oh yeah, they were never, they never...
It wasn't like
at least in
the
my,
light in your eyes.
Oh no. In my imagination, I never once betrayed my crush on you, although we have these letters and now when I read them, I'm like, boy, that guy was smitten.
Right.
So yeah, we'll see. We're gonna try to find ways to deepen our collaboration.
But I think the pandemic period for us has been very helpful because it's grounded us more, literally.
Yeah, sure.
We've not been able to travel as much, and we even when we have had the opportunities to travel, we just haven't been, and it's been a really difficult but also productive time to really think about what we want to do. What our short time on this planet should be spent doing. And like I think I'm starting to be like cautiously optimistic
right.
yeah. about doing more public community-based in-person things.
Yeah, it's so great that we have you in our city, both of you and your family, and you're giving back to the community, including people and Sarah, including a lot of artists from Indianapolis and people you met here in Indianapolis, including here in this actual space we're in. Pablo was here, Pablo Helguera, and so supporting artists in that way of, and you didn't only talk to famous artists, you talked to all kinds. So that's something that has really made a big difference in our city. And then John, all of the work you do to talk about Indianapolis too, I think is super important for us. And
thank you.
Yeah.
And the Indy 500 review is basically also a review of Indianapolis.
I think. Yeah. So it's a love letter, a little bit of a love letter. Yeah. yeah.
But there's an actual, and how many stars did you give Indianapolis?
I think 4.
Good. Yeah.
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Well, and we are likewise super grateful for all that you and your amazing team do
thank
you. Here
it's
at
really wonderful.
Big Car Tube Factory. And it's so exciting to see the growth and what's coming up for you guys.
So if people, thank you very much. So if people want to find you, your things, if, mm-hmm. Where are the best places to go?
So online? What I'm working on right now is Ours Poetica, O-U-R-S, Poetica on YouTube. You can so just search for it.
Okay.
And then otherwise, I'm occasionally on Instagram at The Art Assignment.
Okay.
I'm on Twitter as John Green, but quite reluctantly. In terms of where I'm...
You're on TikTok, John.
In terms of where I feel the most creative interest and also concern, it's definitely TikTok.
Yeah.
I'm literally John Green on TikTok.
Okay, well, people can find you there. Thank you both so much for your time today. It was great to see you and have you here.
Thanks for having us.
All right,
thank you.